So we're gonna try and do Kafka. We'll see how good we do. I'm kind of out of practice.
It's kind
of
like violin.
I feel kind of rusty.
It's kind of like a violinist say, "We're gonna do Brahms." Gosh, a high bar.
I will. I got excited about doing this just randomly one day when I came into the bookshop, and you started talking about the Metamorphosis, and you were talking about how Kafka really does follow the strangeness of one day you wake up as an insect. Like, he just follows it from the beginning to the end. And then, just by chance, and this is just me making connections that probably make no sense, is you had on your counter a book that was about logic. And I was like, Kafka really follows through the logic of his stories. He sets up a premise, and he follows through the logic. And that, I think, accounts for one of the fundamental misunderstandings that people have about Kafka. Is like, one of the famous stories about Kafka that a lot of people have trouble parsing is Kafka would sit at his desk and laugh at what he was writing. It's like there's tale of his neighbors hearing him just like crack himself up.
Which is so ironic, because that's what I said to you, was that somebody bought it, and I said, I think he's the funniest writer ever, and I'll pick it up and open it at random, and I'll just start laughing. And so I said, well, the least I can do is read the whole book, and then it's not funny anymore. Right? It was like, I was astonished, man. It's not funny anymore. But if you pick out a line here and there, you're going, this is the funniest line ever. So yeah, you can see it.
Right. Well, logic isn't supposed to be funny, right? That's what I learned from that logic book, is that there is a fallacy of deterring, derailing a conversation through laughter.
Right.
You derail the logic by having laughter.
Right. But what I was misinterpreting as humor is basically deadpan. I mean, the whole thing about deadpan is you don't know which side of the divide it is.
Right.
Without some clue from the comedian or the person.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
So, I mean, the deadpan lines throughout the Metamorphosis are just killing. And if you just open it up, you just go, oh my God, that's just hilarious, man.
I love it.
Yeah, so anyway, that was kind of the historical context of our conversation.
Yeah. And it's so perfect when you think of Kafka, I think, is just somebody who has taken the logic of literature and sort of just flipped it on its head by doing it perfectly well, right? It's like,
absolutely.
Like, he just does it perfectly well,
right.
And that in and of itself exposes the flaws of logic,
right?
Because, like, the thing that's wrong with logic is doing logic perfectly. Because there's no perfect logic in human life, you know.
Well, you take the messiness of life, and that's a perfect analysis, because that's what's so devastating about the Metamorphosis is, you see where it's going. His sister, whom he loves and dotes on and gives money and wants to see be happy, she finally is totally repulsed by him. And that's inevitable.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, an adolescent girl. And, I mean, look, I mean, it's so devastating, I can't believe it. And when I look back and I said, I was telling people I thought it was funny. God.
But I think you were closer to the truth of what Kafka was actually trying to accomplish, right?
Right.
Because having someone turn into a bug is inherently ridiculous. I mean, there's no way anybody's ever going to just randomly wake up as a bug. And the thing I thought was interesting, I don't remember if this was your idea or mine, but choosing Gregor to turn into a bug is kind of one of these... like, what if he had turned into a donkey or a cat or, you know, just any amount of other... Like, those would all be slightly more sympathetic.
Right.
But, like, a giant cockroach type thing, you know, then it's like nobody's ever going to love you. No one's ever going to feel sympathetic for you. Like, no matter if they even know it's you, like, even the people that love you the most are just never quite... I mean, I don't know. Maybe if you're... That could be a variation on writing the Metamorphosis, is a His father was like an entomologist, and his father actually now just gets like obsessed with him. He's like, "What? You turned into a giant?" Now
some writer out there is going to be listening to this and say, "Yes, I can sell this to Random House."
Well, it's their burden. That's fantastic. Afterwards,
no, you're right. That's the incredible thing about that. That's the how the absurd intruded into existential thought was that. Yeah, you start with an absurd premise, and then it becomes intensely real.
Yeah.
I mean, what the heck is going on here, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's why Kafka's always been a saint of the existential.
Yeah. And he just... I do wonder sometimes... I mean, I think he's a great writer. I mean, he's always been one of my favorites. Sainthood, yeah. I'm sorry, I'm just trying to parse in my mind. Because sometimes I think there are things with writers that people are almost more interested in their backstory than the actual work they produce, in a way. I don't know if the same is true with Kafka. Like, he just has this great suffering artist backstory of, like, you know...
Well, he loved to write.
Yeah.
He admitted that he loved to write more than he wanted to deal with the beautiful women that loved him. You know, I mean...
Were there multiple beautiful women that loved him?
I saw pictures of him. No, he had some pretty hot little Jewish girls that loved him. And there was always a complication, and he always broke them off.
Well...
So he loved to write. And we're talking about it. I mean, whether you're playing chess or doing physics or whatever, there are human beings that really have this autistic side of them that they really like to live this life. And I think there is a line where actually Kafka admits feeling guilt that he enjoys writing more than he enjoys living, you know. But... but you know, I was reading
Joseph... God, that sounds like a good problem to have. I kind of wish I had that problem some days.
I'm just reading Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces, and he talks about the diamond, the lotus, that... And it was interesting, I was listening to John le Carré's interview in 1989. He said, spies and writers are a lot alike, because they both have this little kind of cold diamond in them that observes.
Yeah.
And they're charming, usually, and they're here to entertain, but there's a side of them that is watching like a photographer, you know, in a war.
Yeah.
That I got to get the right angle on this photograph. That's the diamond.
Yeah.
And he talks about how in the diamond and the lotus in spirituality is the flesh of the world, the passion, the beauty, the warmth, da da da, right?
Uh-huh.
But in that, there's the cold diamond of eternity, which is God, right?
Okay.
But in Kafka, it's the observant mind. It's like...
the cold diamond of eternity.
I really like to hang out observing and creating work out of my... you know, observation out of this standpoint.
Well, and that's such an interesting way to put it. And it's kind of what I do really love and appreciate about Kafka. It's like what I mean, everybody talks about the metamorphosis and for some significant portion of the trial as well, even though the trial kind of never really did much for me. It's a bit too long but what really has always done it for me is Kafka's damn parables. His like little, yeah. His like little short right. stories that he, who knows where these would even have been published? How would anybody even read them? But
right, and one must also refer to the fact that Albert Camus' best novels are fables.
Mm-hmm.
He got that from Kafka, man.
Yeah, you think?
Yeah. Oh yeah, they're fables. You know, I mean, whether it's The Stranger or The Fall, these are parables, but they're more like human, right?
Yeah,
they're more
fleshy.
Yeah, but not that much. But they're pretty much parables, and they veer into what we're talking about is, you know, the science fiction parable, right? Where you don't really want to spend a lot of time developing characters. You just want to give the idea of what we as human beings go through on this earth. You know? Like, this is going to happen to you.
Well, like what you're talking about with the diamond, it's like you want to keep that as clear as possible because, as you know, the fleshiness of the rest of the flower is so much larger and so much more approachable to almost everybody else. It's like, how do you make sure that diamond gets through? You know?
The diamond is the perceptive quality of the artist or the spy. That was the metaphor.
I get it. But that's also what I look for. Like, maybe this is just me being weird and not like a lot of people.
That's just what art and science is all about, man.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
It's that detachment. You got to sit back. And Kafka.
Is there something wrong with detachment?
Well, you have to. You've got to be seeing through the diamond so that it's in focus, you know? I mean, that's just how it is. It's all about optics.
Right. But if the whole world was spies, I mean, that wouldn't be great either, obviously.
Well, that's an interesting concept, actually.
Well, I mean, I think that's something.
There's a sci-fi novel for you. Yeah, yeah. God, we're giving away these ideas. We're giving them away.
I really became comfortable with that many years ago. I remember after I finished one of my first books, and someone's like, "Oh no, you got to copyright it. You got to make sure nobody steals this." It's like, you know what? If somebody steals this and they can actually sell it to somebody the way I cannot, more power to them.
I know.
It's like, not my business.
I know. Well, that's the nice balance to the cold observer is the magnanimity of saying, "Yeah, this is a great." But yeah, anyway, I was just kind of reading that and we always hit these points where I go it's probably because I'm out of beer.
Well, there's more.
Okay, we got another reading here.
Well, I just for the hell of it, I just want to read one of these little parables at the end, and I think I'm going to read the one that's literally called a parable, just because I think it's The one that I loved when I was 20 was this one called The Emperor. A man doubted that the emperor was descended from the gods. He asserted that the emperor was our rightful sovereign. He did not doubt the emperor's divine mission. That was evident to him. It was only the divine descent that he doubted. This, naturally, did not cause much of a stir. When the surf flings a drop of water onto the land, that does not interfere with the eternal rolling of the sea. On the contrary, it is caused by it. It's just,
Right, absolutely. Yeah.
I think it gives you a sense of how he then went on to write his stories, like what he was interested in. There's this weird sort of religiosity that I always enjoy in writers, even if they're not directly speaking of religion. I mean, mostly I don't want them to be directly speaking of religion, but like to be in relation to it, to be in relation to that, the eternal, right? The perceiver that is God,
the diamond.
Yeah, the diamond. Yeah. That was such a good connection that you brought up. Didn't even talk about that beforehand.
Ha! Yeah, we've rehearsed this. It's been a hard day with our assistant producers.
Okay. So this one's called On Parables. Many complain that the words of the wise are always merely parables and of no use in daily life, which is the only life we have. When the sage says, "Go over," he does not mean that we should cross to some actual place, which we could do anyhow if the labor were worth it. He means some fabulous yonder, something unknown to us, something that he cannot designate more precisely either, and therefore cannot help us here in the very least. All these parables really set out to say merely that the incomprehensible is incomprehensible, and we already know that. But the cares we have to struggle with every day, that is a different matter. Concerning this, a man once said, "Why such reluctance? If you only followed the parables, you yourselves would become parables, and with that, rid of all your daily cares." Another said, "I bet that is also a parable." The first said, "You have won." The second said, "But unfortunately, only in parable." The first said, "No, in reality, in parable, you have lost."
That's a wonderful.
Yeah, it's just, it's wonderful. It's like, I understand why he was laughing. And I don't, although I'm not exactly sure how to explain it. I've often tried, but like a writer we've lampooned together, David Foster Wallace, that was one thing he was constantly had a problem with. He's like, why did Kafka think he was funny? This is obviously so sad, you know, like all this logic, that's obviously so sad. But that's the point, is like the logic has the failure built in, you know, it's like it has a built-in failure mechanism.
God, isn't that... Now that was a brilliant line, Jonah.
There we go.
Any project that does not have a built-in failure is doomed to failure, man. Total failure. It'll be a lesson. The failure will be lessened somehow.
Well, you kind of have to let your audience see the failure, right? I mean, otherwise, otherwise it's, well, I'm not sure I really want to continue.
That's fantastic, man. You're absolutely right, man. As a writer, if somebody said that to me and I was like starting out writing,
but it's still got to be great, though. I mean, it's not like you can just do what this Alan Lightman did with Einstein.
Well, it's very paradoxical. What you said is paradoxical. Yeah. I mean, it's not like, you know, it's one of them parables, Jonah. It's one of them parables. And you can't even take it at face value. You can't take it at any value, but you're going, I don't really know. I would say, well, did Shakespeare think, well, yeah, I'm going to write it in rhymed verse when people are getting, you know, massacred, and that's built-in failure, right? Because these people are obviously not going to be speaking rhymed verse when they're hacking away, or their wife is saying, "No, I've found another man," you know?
Well, what I interestingly heard about Shakespeare that I thought seemed pretty on the nose was Shakespeare kind of wrote something into his plays for everybody. Like, he wrote, like, a little bit of comedy bodiness.
Sure, yeah.
Like, you know, he got the highfalutin language for the upper-class people in the crowd that want to hear something.
Right, right.
Kind of poetic, and then you got the body double entendre. And
Right. Yeah, that's kind of a general strategic idea. I think he was listening and hanging. You know, he died at 54 from drinking with people like you and Mark and Zach.
Well, I
like Thursday night, man. And you listen to them, and you're writing. You're always no. There's no doubt. The genius of Shakespeare was he was such a powerful creative spirit, and he's brave enough to hang out and get drunk with crazy people like you, man, and paying the price.
Yeah.
So I want to go on to my concept of how Borges and all the science fiction guys.
Yeah, let's do this.
Just stole from Kafka. This is from The Great Wall of China. Obviously, the powers that be have decided there's going to be a Great Wall, and they hire all these engineers who have all sorts of integrity. Accordingly, while they were still exalted by the jubilant celebrations marking the completion of the 1,000 yards of wall, they were sent far, far away, saw on their journey finished sections of the wall rising here and there, came past the quarters of the high command, and were presented with badges of honor, heard the rejoicings of new armies of labor streaming past the depths of the land, saw forests being cut down to become supports for the wall, saw mountains being hewn into stones for the wall, heard at the holy shrines hymn rising in which the pious prayed for the completion of the wall. All this assuaged their impatience. The quiet life of their homes, where they rested some time, strengthened them. The humble credulity with which their reports were listened to, the confidence with which the people, the simple and peaceful burgher, believed in the eventual completion of the wall, all this filled their hearts with a new buoyancy. Like eternally hopeful children, they then said farewell to their homes. The desire once more to labor on the wall of the nation became irresistible. You know, I'm talking about that sci-fi. That is where you place a civilization in some historical context, and it's like right now, people never change. Their stupidity.
Yeah.
Their emptiness. You know, it's just like so devastating. And you know he's laughing when he wrote that too. But the you notice how he repeats the wall at the end? This beautiful cadencing.
Yeah.
Of rhetorical cadencing is just like matchless, man. You said it you know, earlier, what a great writer he is, man. Jeez. Yeah.
It's interesting, this idea of eternal ideas also being empty. Like the, I'm sorry, I'm just putting, I'm just making a random connection of in what you said. Like,
I think you're becoming like a an oracle here, man.
Well, I mean,
you've been walking along the Portneuf in the winter dark.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly what I've been doing. That's exactly what I've been doing. Usually 3/4 drunk.
Okay, keep going. So I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, I guess it's a... Well, I've been thinking a lot about the eternal return. You know, I've been essentially thinking, you know, even how far back where we think of human knowledge, like how long do we retain human knowledge for? You know, 11 generations? 22 generations?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
500 generations?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't really matter what number you put on it. As long as that number isn't infinite, everything's always going to come back around, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're just going to have to follow my logic here.
Oh, yeah.
In that circle,
sure.
in the eternal return, as
sure,
Nietzsche
yeah.
would say,
sure, yeah.
there is emptiness, right? Because there's,
right.
because you're when you return to the same place in the middle of the circle, you
absolutely
have nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the...
It's a bit of a stretch.
No, you're absolutely right, and... But I mean, Lao Tzu says that God is emptiness.
Mm.
You know, it's like when you accept God and follow Him, it's emptiness.
Really?
Oh,
Lao
yeah.
Tzu?
Oh, yeah. Sure, yeah.
Did he use the word God? Was that his term, or is that just the classic English translation?
He didn't. I how do you know that I... put that in there, but it is God because God is the divine, you know. But the divine is empty. I mean, when you give your love to God, you are accepting the emptiness, the void. I mean,
okay. This is why me and religious people are not that far removed from each other. It's like, even though I don't technically believe in God, I believe in that idea, which is that emptiness.
You just said it.
Yeah.
I said, yeah. I mean, no, Lao Tzu said that. I mean, you know, you give your soul to that. It's like, okay, that's it, man. And when you said that, I was thinking, man, that's pretty wild. yeah, because, you know, infinite, that's what infinity is, you know, and like, as you said, then you brought up infinity. So, it's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, pretty off, a little off topic for Kafka. Although, you know, he was a writer, so. And a thinking man's writer.
So did he ever use the word infinity in any of his writing?
I don't know. I'm not. I'm not.
Well, we're hoping our readers will.
they'll
fact check on this.
They'll look through.
Yeah.
But he also just has a. Well, I mean, so the story I was going to talk about, and this, for listeners, is just from the basic Kafka, which I can highly recommend. It'll probably cost you $2 on Amazon, and you'll get...
Isn't that great?
Great enjoyment out of it. But I was going to read something for it, but I think I'm just gonna do a synopsis just off the top of my head. Is the story of Josephine the singer, where Josephine has a beautiful singing voice, and everyone enjoys her singing voice, and they really like her, but she's always constantly trying to petition herself that she shouldn't have to work because she's a good singer. She should just be a singer, and they should just let her do that. But that's not really their society. They're like, well, that doesn't really make sense to us. If you don't work, I mean, we're like, yeah, we like your singing, but maybe we don't like it as much as you not doing any work. You know, but she's constantly petitioning. She's always telling them, you know, it's like, well, if you don't let me get off work, I'm going to sing worse next time. And she's always threatening. And every time she does, everyone says, well, it sounds the same. You know, it's like, if this is her worst, it sounds basically the same to us. But then he has this great line, which I think has to be true for most artists. Is she's always reaching for this goal that she knows is unachievable, and all the more that is what makes her chase after it, is its inachievableness. If it could be achieved, mm-hmm. she would simply put another obstacle in her path mm-hmm. for mm-hmm. it to. And I was like, well, look, that's got to be him, right? I mean, like, that's just the basic artist viewpoint. Like, if it could be achieved, I would just create another obstacle for myself.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah. And no, that's absolutely true. It brings us two really important ideas that are not original.
Well, that's fine.
Desire is more important than
the consummation. The fulfillment, yeah.
The excitement of it. Definitely true with being an artist, with being human. We live in a state of desire. And the other idea was, oh gosh, I lost it. Darn it all.
No, you'll come back to it. But I do, I think this is not exactly desire. I don't have a ready-made idea to come back. I would just say it's a little bit different than desire.
No, that was my subsidiary thought, and I forgot the main one, damn it, which is brilliant, which is close to what we're talking about. But so what were we talking about again?
Kafka.
Well, you got to help me because I had two. The first one was...
Well, Josephine the singer. So
Josephine the singer.
So she's trying to petition to get off work. And
right. I got all that.
Yeah. And then I should just have the line in front of me.
Right. And on top of that, it doesn't matter whether she sings badly or well. They hear it all the same, which is the, you know, which is the fate of the artist. And then what was the next one?
This line is like him coming in as a narrator.
Oh, that's what I was going to say. So that's what I really loved about it, was that Jung would say, hey, this is the female anima soul intermediary of Kafka. I mean, he's putting his whole soul, his whole artistic soul into this story. This is me. This is Franz.
Yeah.
I'm this beautiful singer.
Yeah.
And
that's a classic thing. I mean, I remember that even in one of Bello's books, was, you know, Bello giving Kafka a little bit of flack because there is something kind of feminine about it. Like, there's something feminine about logic, I think. I think people think of logic as being a very masculine trait, but I don't know. I'm not really convinced. I'm sort of just formulating this now, but
interesting, yeah.
But
it's totally contrary to accepted thought. Yeah. So yeah, go with it, man. Yeah, right. If it's contrary to accepted thought, you go with it, man.
This is just the contrarian inside.
Yeah.
Wants to chase any contrary idea.
But you know, no, that's the beautiful confirmation of Jungian psychology. I mean, this most beautiful truthful story where he's really telling the truth about himself, he chooses a woman who's a singer. I mean, what more wonderful image do you want of your soul than a woman singing? You know, I mean,
yeah,
that's how it is. I mean, you can't say this in a football bar in Cleveland or Pocatello, but still,
right? But you're not wrong.
But
right?
Yeah, no, it's absolutely true. You know, it's absolutely true, and you know, and whether all that's true or not. There's definitely, you know, the way that you, masking's the wrong word, but it's such a beautiful story, the way you just simplified it. And, yeah, the interesting thing, I think more important is that when he places it in, the persona of the woman singer, he, in a kind of forgiveness, in a kind of setting aside, he's not saying, look, I'm poor Franz, right, and here is my voice and nobody listens to me. He displaces that and he gives it to a beautiful young woman,
yeah,
full of idealism, full of tribulation, full of non-acceptance, right? Or they accept her, but no, you play our game, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's a sweeter way of doing it.
Yeah.
So whether it's Jungian or not is actually now up for grabs, because it's a more beautiful way of telling the story. Because there's no saying, okay, Franz, you know, or...
Well, it can be Jungian and not be... Like, it can be the anima and not be you, right? I mean, that's the whole point of that.
Right. I actually think artistically is more solid, and artistically it's a better story because he makes it a woman.
Yeah, right.
And now it's not like, oh, you're kind of whining a little bit, Franz.
You're right, if it had just been him.
Yeah,
like if it had just been him. But everybody can sympathize with a woman singer. Yeah. But...
Well, you're right. That's what I'm saying. I mean, 2-1, it's the artistic framing is superior, is more important than whatever Jung has to say. I mean, wherever it comes from, who really cares?
Yeah.
The story is better if it's a beautiful girl, you know, obviously.
And you would have probably been great as a fiction
writer. And I see him in here every day, man. These beautiful women, young women, full of soul and wanting to... Oh, man, I just have the greatest job ever. Two or three of them came in today. They're coming back to ISU. You know, they're buying a couple of theater majors. Oh, man. And you just see the...
Did you ever get involved with a theater girl? They're a little bit...
No. Nor a ballet. I was at the University of Utah, so there were a lot of ballet ladies, but they were a little undernourished, man.
Yeah. It kind of loses injured. Its sex appeal,
That's what's so extraordinary about... This is a sidelight, Jonah. If you were to look back at the castrati of, right to develop that singing voice,
castrated young boys.
Yes, because the voice is like stronger and the ballet girls. I was in a house with like four of them, man, and God, they were like blue almost. And they were undernourished and they were always injured.
Yeah.
And bitter?
Yeah.
Oh, man, I've never seen such sacrifice from human beings. Oh, God, I'm glad we're talking about this.
Yeah.
The sacrifice of young women deciding they're going to crack a beer, man. This is like...
And you know what I learned that surprised me from my article I did on strippers? A lot of ballerinas become strippers.
Mm-hmm.
And they probably have a better time of it.
A lot better time, man. Put on a little weight.
Those rednecks
do not like... Yeah. No, I think this is so great. We're going to dedicate this to all the young ballerinas out there. Like, baby, I mean, you talk about Christ carrying the cross. You are really going to suffer.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah, that really hangs with me, that memory.
I like the idea that they're all blue. For some reason, I'm not always big on like these color metaphors, but the idea of just picturing them as being slightly blue tinted.
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
I might have stolen it from Picasso. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe.
That's why I probably did. But no, they were. Oh my gosh. But the sacrifice and the desire, that's what's so really cruel, man, and tragic, is that the desire of these young women and then the sacrifice is like, it's equal, you know. I mean, like, oh my gosh. You and I, as writers, as existential writers, Jonah,
yeah,
we have not had to pay these prices, man. I think it's great.
It's a different kind of price, you know. It's not desire doesn't really come as much into it, really.
No, I was just talking about the deprivation of not eat, being able to
eat.
Oh,
yeah.
The injuries,
the physicality. But they'll be done. I mean, the only way they keep suffering is if they actually make it, right? I mean, if they don't make it, then they're just, at 21, they become strippers or they do something. They do something completely different, you know. It's like, you know, I've been suffering for a decade longer than that. Yeah. My suffering is less. I'm not denying that at all. My suffering on a daily basis is much less, but it's happened for a much longer period of time.
Yeah, statistically, it would be the same.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Like a lot of suffering. One great. Short burst or a little bit of suffering.
No, that's great.
A long period. Okay, but to return.
But I have to,
okay,
on a serious note, saying that you still have that that desire and that energy to create, and these young women lose it, man. I mean, they're having kids, or they're maybe dancing amateurly here and there. But
I'm not really sure I have the desire, though. I've just built an internal mechanism that's like, look, the world is pointless. You might as well, like, even if what you do no one gives a shit about and it's going to be pointless for the rest of your life, it doesn't matter because the whole world's pointless.
This is why, gentle reader, you want to become a writer, because the world is pointless. You might as well do something pointless. Oh, yes. We have hit a profound, after so many profound thoughts. That was tremendous.
Well,
yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Makes me sometimes think I'm trying to justify things to myself, but okay. But to return to Kafka and to return to this idea of work, which I think is interesting with Kafka, what I was saying about Saul Bellow is, like, even Saul Bellow was a little bit incredulous that Kafka once met with George Steiner. Apparently, do you know George Steiner?
Sure, yeah,
yeah, mm-hmm. Of course you do. But he met with George Steiner and he lamented.
I've never read him.
I mean, it's not terrible, is it? It's just, I mean, it starts to get a little bit hippy dippy with angels and passing through dimensions and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm,
but,
mm-hmm.
But he met with Steiner and he like lamented to Steiner about the fact that he was this great artist trapped in the body of a insurance clerk. And even Bellow found this a little bit hard to swallow.
So,
you know,
Steiner,
like,
so Steiner recorded that?
Yeah, that's a good question.
It is a good question.
That's a good question. No, Bellow just used, I think Bellow just used it in Humboldt's Gift, as far as I remember. It was just kind of a throwaway line, but at the time I had read some Steiner, so it just stuck in my memory. Yeah, I don't know who recorded it. Maybe he made it up. I don't know. Maybe Bellow.
Well, yeah, no, that's an interesting point, because Kafka published a little bit, but the Steiner would, I think that's quite exemplary that Steiner would even mention, you know, seeing this skinny Jewish kid from Prague, you know.
Well, that's true too. Yeah.
So that's an interesting story. There's another novel, Steiner Meets Kafka. We've given our readership three.
That one would actually be fun. I might enjoy writing that.
That would be a good one.
But all these fun ideas.
It would be a hell of a lot better than Einstein's Dreams. That's damn sure. You want to get into you want to get into historical juju? What the heck, man?
Historical juju. Actually better than science juju. Not science fiction, like what what Kafka's doing, right? It's like, well, it depends on how you take the word juju. But it's not technically science. Well.
What I read, The Great Wall of China, is science fiction. Because because it is
But it's historical, like it literally
but
happened.
no, it's not. The whole attitude of
They
the
literally built a great wall, though.
yeah, but the people, the whole psychology and the mass psychology, the pathetic, pitiful mass psychology that is so similar to human beings in all eras is there, man.
Yeah, I mean
And
it's
like you were talking
pathetic.
about the emptiness of the perennial
Yeah.
ideas, man. I mean, it's just like, I just read in that one paragraph, it's like, man, what are you talking about? Trump's got his wall.
Right.
Great, man. And everybody's happy, but they were happy about the wall, you know? It's
Yeah.
like so pathetic, man.
It's pathetic, but it is also logical. I mean it's the failure of logic, right? I mean it's like you Like, okay, well, we don't want these Mongolians coming to raid us. What are we going to do? We're
Oh no,
going
it
to
has
build.
nothing to do with the Mongolians, man.
Well, the Great Wall does.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And
You don't think
Trump's,
the Great Wall had anything to do with
well,
it?
I mean, this is totally so far beyond the main point of what I've. It's mainly a disagreement between you and I. The main brilliance of that line is the pitifulness of mass delusion, you know, from the engineers down to the people.
Yeah.
This mass delusion of, well, this wall is so great, and we're just gonna like give away a lot of medals, and we're gonna have festivals, and we're gonna have hymns in the church, you know, because this is just the greatest thing ever,
Yeah.
you know. And what's the Great Wall now? Nothing, man.
A
And
tourist attraction.
that's it is a tourist attraction, but you got to go damn far for this tourist attraction. No, but
it's
you've
really
been to
a
China. Did you
yeah.
go to the Great Wall?
No, it didn't interest
See,
me at
my
all.
point is made.
Yeah.
Why?
I was like, why? I don't know. Yeah.
That's the point.
The
That's
Summer
what.
Palace was really
Oh,
interesting.
yeah.
I'd highly suggest. And even the Forbidden Palace too is really cool.
Oh, it's gotta be, yeah.
I mean, it's just so big and empty. I mean, really, it's like you walk, like if there weren't crowds of people in there, you'd be walking through it and I mean, it was very cinematic. That's why
Right.
one of my favorite movies is The Last Emperor.
Right.
Bernardo Bertolucci
Right,
is
right, right.
The Last Emperor.
Right, right.
Great film.
I've never seen that. I've got to see that.
Yeah. Great film.
Right.
I tried to write a story once that was about ostensibly about the Second Opium War.
And you didn't write it.
I did. It just wasn't very good.
Well, give me the copy, man. Well, let me read it.
fucking writers.
Well, that's the great thing about me, man. I just got one book, man. Thousand
That's not
pages.
true. Oh yeah, well,
Thousand
right.
pages, man. That's it. And I was actually walking across the parking lot today and thinking, you know, should I actually write these fun little stories that I've been thinking about, or, you know, this different stuff?
Well, just do them like Kafka. Do like little paragraphs, you know? Just get them
Right.
real tight.
Right. I dreamed one the other night of I could hear the voice. It was lately, since King Arthur had been changed into a toad by Merlin after a drinking party late one night, he came to be hopping around the halls of Camelot. I thought, that's a pretty good opening sentence, Will. I think you
Yeah.
ought to write that. But
And then you just end it like in 4 sentences.
right.
But what's the ending, right? This
Well, I don't know. All I know is that there's an essential truth here that power, you know, being king, does not even compare
Well, here's the question.
to being in power does not compare to being in possession of the Tao, of the emptiness, you know, of what really life makes life fun, right?
Yeah.
I mean, when you lose the joy of life, that's what I like about our podcast. I mean, still the feeling, gentle reader, when we start stop having fun here, would you please come and shoot us? Hire some assassins.
I mean, that's the only reason. Yeah,
I know. Yeah. I know. The feeling of play and bringing to this. So I was in the bar the other night, and after I'd had my hamburger, and the most divine, beautiful Mason, who always wears a knit that falls off one shoulder, and
on purpose, and do you think, or accident?
On purpose, and she pulls it to, you know, when she,
okay,
and she always knows my name, and she seems happy to see me, and after I'd finished my hamburger, she says, which is really good, and she says, "Well, how is your burger?" And I said, "Well, that was pretty ironic." And she said, "What do you mean by that?" And I said, "Well, I didn't say, well, pro forma, you have to say that. So I can just as easily say you are being ironic by saying, how is your burger, right?" And she said, so, but it had me confused for a minute. I was thinking, okay, what's going on here? And then I was thinking, it was the idea of the pro forma in business or normal life, you are given these standard phrases to say, and they have no meaning at all. Somebody has told you to say those. So, if you say these, they have no meaning. But, and then I mentioned that, and then she was kind of like confused because she was busy. And then I thought about it a minute, and I said, okay, I'm sorry. When you said, it's just like the guy goes into the bar.
Yeah.
And he gets his, he's got a dog, and he wants the dog to have a drink. And she said, what do you mean about deadpan? I think I threw that in there somewhere. I said, okay, I got it all figured out. The guy goes in the bar, gets his dog a drink. The beautiful waitress with the net that slips over one beautiful mm-hmm. shoulder and is blonde and smart says
this is like one of those long
how did you
jokes,
like right? the drink how did your dog like the drink? And I said, that's ironic when she says, and how did your dog like the drink? And he says, he said he thought it was a little dry. That's deadpan. So that's the difference between ironic and deadpan. So I got away with that. But it got me thinking of the three levels of discourse, right, of human communication. Parole, according to the French dickheads.
Parole.
Yeah. Parole is, you got pro forma, and that's where irony plays off of, is pro forma. You're expected to say pro forma, and you say it exactly that way, but it's ironic. But in the right situation, if you say it deadpan, then it's really funny, right?
Yeah.
I know.
Okay.
It was like, that's good. It was like the light bulb went off in my mind, man. I was going, okay.
That's good.
That's how I'm going to try and write some literature now.
Yeah, that's good. And yeah, that relates to what I consider to be the modern misunderstanding of irony. I think you've laid it out perfectly.
Right.
It's like
right.
people think irony is just was just this 90s version of being kind of aloof about everything. But that's yeah. not true. It's like you're taking the form to task. Like,
kill.
That's the point of irony, right?
Jonah, this is why I love you, man. That's exactly right. You are taking pro forma to task.
Yeah.
You're saying, I am not going to play this game, and then if somebody can come back with like the rejoinder, right, and it's then it's deadpan, then you're playing along with the irony.
Yeah.
And that's the deadpan. And then it's funny, Mason's really cool, she said, so there's always a kind of one-upmanship. And I said, oh yeah, it's always play.
Yeah, right.
But you're right, if you're not trying to like one up, so irony, pro forma, irony, and then deadpan, and then, I mean, how how quick can you be? I mean, how far can you carry it? But
okay, well now let's take this back to Kafka. Kafka obviously probably sat 8 hours a day filling out forms. Is Kafka ironic? Is his essential anima irony? I mean, like,
I think that's beautiful. His essential writing is ironic, but he enters into this deadpan.
Yeah, deadpan irony.
It's just like deadpan,
which is,
man,
the highest form.
Is the highest form. It's just like, but you cannot. But yeah, whether it's true that you can do the deadpan, you've got to set it off with the irony. The deadpan is the response to the ironic. Whether you can do deadpan, you can obviate the intermediary irony with deadpan, I think. And then it becomes both ironic and deadpan.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's just, I'm just...
I kind of like your first...
I'm just shouting, yeah.
Yeah, I like your first one best is like deadpan pro forma is the highest form of irony because it's...
Right.
It's but also, that's what people find confusing about Kafka. That's why people are confused when Kafka's laughing.
And that's why I thought he was being funny.
Yeah, right. Well, so, and he
this
was.
Is the greatest
was.
Deadpan humor.
Yeah.
I mean, in other words, I think deadpan is deader than irony. I think deadpan is like a double dry martini to an ironic vermouth, right? You know,
you're right.
Deadpan just gets right at it. If you can hit the deadpan right away off of pro forma, man, then you fucking killed it, man.
But it's so difficult for most people to get.
Yeah, you got to be smart. Yeah. Well, you get to do it, you got to be smart.
Well, you also you've
because
to...
it's intonation. I think deadpan has a little darker intonation to it than irony.
Sure. I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's right.
Yeah, you got to like hit it right away. You got to be like right there.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
Now, here's something I would like to explore. Why?
In other words, you can read irony a lot quicker than deadpan. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. I'm on board. I got
it.
Yeah,
yeah. So what were you saying?
Well, I was going to say, where did the word deadpan come from?
The face is the pan, and the guy is like dead, like, oh, you want to fuck my wife? It's like, that's deadpan.
Okay, but why is the
His facial expression is dead. Deadpan.
This sounds like a bastardization of a French saying. You know, it's like, I can just picture the French saying something about, you know, like, the cooking in the pan, and that being the face, you know? It's like the ingredients of the face are like the emotions in a pan. You know, it's like, so the... I don't remember what the name for it. Like,
your chef is pouring through here, man. I had no idea.
My inner chef.
No, the a man's face is his pan.
Okay.
And deadpan is like.
Yeah.
Is like. You want a cigarette?
Looking into a dead man's face.
You want a cigarette? Yeah. You want a cigarette? I mean, there's no emotion.
Yeah.
But there's a resistance there. It's like. What?
You know, the only I think this is true that it's the highest form, but the only problem is the only people I see who get really good at that, I don't think of as being particularly intelligent.
Well, no, because I have made a career of getting people pissed off at me in bars at laughing uproariously to total fucking idiots. And then they look at me like, what the fuck, man? What the fuck are you laughing at? I've done it a lot, man.
Yeah.
I've done a lot. When people are really speaking from the heart and they're just like total losers, and I just start laughing because I think, why are you talking about this, man? Obviously, you're trying to make me laugh. You wouldn't talk about, you know, all this. That's happened to me several times.
Huh. I wonder if that doesn't have something to do with Aristotle's conception of how men communicate with each other. You know, like about how men specifically try and hide their own personal problems from each other because they're like, well, I don't want to burden somebody else with my own shit.
That's an interesting point. I think it is an ethic. I think it is a North. I think it is an American ethic that when you go to a party or go to a bar, you're there to laugh. You're not to hear somebody
unload on you.
You know, so yeah, that's probably part of it. But it's also political too. I mean, in Idaho, you hear all sorts of, you know, like, you know, you're at a bar and some guy talks about lizards people. You know, you can start fucking laughing like, this is the funniest guy on earth. And then he looks at you like,
no, this is real, man. I believe in these damn lizards.
I know, man. I know. Now you know the burden that I've lived under all my life. Yeah.
Well, you were always willing to confront it, so I got to give you credit for that.
Well, you know, I get a big kick out of life, and I'm ready to laugh right away. I'm ready to give people the benefit of the doubt, and there was me and Kafka. I'm laughing at Kafka, and probably the most heartbreaking piece of literature ever written, and it's sci-fi. How does he do it?
Yeah, it's sci-fi. Yeah.
How does he do it, man?
Yeah,
oh God!
Yeah. But I feel like we need to create a different category because to me, sci-fi is. I mean, the best sci-fi series I've read is this Chinese guy, Liu Cixin.
Third Body.
Yeah, Three Body Problem.
Yeah, Rolf just mentioned today.
Yeah.
He said, like, it's just like devastating, man.
Did he think it was devastating? Oh, see, maybe I have weird reactions.
Well, no, it is funny. It is deadpan. Of course it is.
Yeah.
The young adolescent girls are the ones that tear him apart. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's just true to the Chinese Revolution. That's how the book opens
right.
up.
And then all the boys are kind of going, well, hey, don't kill our professor. And they're thinking,
oh,
well.
He told you about the opening
He gave me the synopsis, yeah.
Yeah.
And damn, I had it in here didn't realize it was so good, and well, they got a good deal on it, and I made $5. So, but yeah, you're right. The irony in it, the comedy in it is definitely there.
Well, I don't.
But it's not funny because
yeah, it's not.
It probably happened. It didn't happen, but that's the idea of, again.
Well,
the echo is in the Bacchae. Where the king says,
the Bacchae?
By Euripides,
oh.
where Dionysus arrives as a god, and all the women are getting drunk and listening to rock and roll and dancing in the hills and having a great time,
yeah.
And the king goes and throws Dionysus in jail, and Dionysus says, "Well, this isn't going to go." So he turns the king into an elk, and sends him running through the fields, and his daughters. And his wife see him, and in this Dionysiac bloodlust, bring him down and tear him limb from limb and eat him, their own father. So that, I mean, there's an echo there. So you know there is,
huh?
Because the females do it, which is a kind of a masculine misogyny if you really look at it.
What is?
Well, I mean, let's face it, man. Men are more prone to fucking destroying people than women are.
Yeah.
By and large.
Well, yeah. Well, except for, I don't know. One of my favorite things at the end of Immortality.
We're back to Peter.
Yeah. That guy? He's drunk and he's meeting his friends and he's got these two women living in his house. He says he leans in close as if divulging a real secret. He goes. Friends, do not take me seriously. This is just a thought. But we have been lucky so far that wars have been only committed by men. If they had been committed by women, they would have been so grotesque and terrible that there would be no human beings left alive.
Right, well, I have to bring people back to the great novel Crawling You Really Like a Man, which...
Oh, who's that by?
Has a scene in which a female otter and a female beaver get in a fight because the female beaver has flooded the den where the female otter has placed her babies.
Is this a real thing?
It's a real true story. I heard it from a guy.
Ah.
And in other words, the otter lady had a nice little creek, fresh fish, little den there. The beaver comes in below, builds the dam, and drowns out all her little babies. So she goes out, and she and the beaver get in a fight. Now, a big beaver and a big otter is pretty evenly matched. And this guy told me that he watched this otter, this beaver, female, fight from like 10 in the morning till like 6 at night until they both, and they would stop. And then they would go back, and just like Ali and Frazier, and they fought until both died. Like, he just went over and looked at him like they fucking fought to the death, two females. So there might be some justification.
Yeah, that kind of selfless vengeance.
Love of the children, man.
Yeah.
And it's just like, no, it was all over. There was nothing left for that female otter, man, but just to, you know, and so this guy told me it happened right up out of Downey, like in the Arkansas Basin up there.
Give me your cup.
I always have to bring my novel into our discussions, you know that?
Yeah, it's good.
So have we brought up the fact that you're going to be the editor of the Craters of the Moon anthology?
Sure.
And we want all our listeners, thank you, Jonah. We want all our listeners to submit an essay or short fiction piece of the Craters of the Moon.
Well, you know, how many of them know about? I don't know. I don't even know.
It could be one.
There's at least one.
I think Colin says he listens to it all the time.
Oh, really? Well, you know, that's the weird thing about writing, though, is I don't know. It's not really that casual, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of people who say they do it casually, but I don't know. That was one of the things I remember. Annie Proulx, Dillard. Andy Dillard?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. She had a writing class, and she was telling her students, it's like, you got to be prepared to take a battle axe to your life, you know, like, you got to be able to be willing to cut it all to shreds.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, that's probably some part of the problem to write well.
What was Eddie Diller's problem?
Well, yeah,
I mean, she wrote a pretty good book.
Yeah.
But, I mean, she was an academic. When academics start talking about fucking, you know, going through Okinawa with a flamethrower, it's like, I kind of go, that's a little over the top.
Okinawa, was that in one of her books? I didn't read that.
No, I'm just saying that, like Tom Spanbar saying, I want you to be a dangerous writer. Oh, come on, man.
Yeah, it's like, what is he even, yeah, what is he talking about?
Even an Idaho Power lineman going up on a fucking telephone pole is more dangerous than anything you're ever gonna do.
That's true.
Right, but yeah no,
that is that, I mean, but that's actually dangerous. I mean,
I'm just saying, man, writing is anyway, but that's my take on it.
Well, you're not wrong.
It's no, I'm not, man. I'm not. Writing is so much fun. I mean, all I gotta do is figure out how to try to make something make sense. It's just like, and failing. It's true.
And failing.
It's true. It's true. But yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right, though. I mean, how do you be a sometime writer? It's impossible. That the idea of sacrifice you're talking about is totally there, man. I mean, you want to be a great athlete? You want to be just an average writer. You just got to sacrifice. You just got to write every day. He's got to figure it out.
Yeah.
And of all the people that I have encouraged to write in here in 30 years, Jonah, guess how many have done anything?
Zip.
Zero.
Yeah.
I'm astonished. Actually, I'm amused. Bemused is the right
word. Well,
yeah,
I mean, I think you should be amused.
Because I get so excited. Because they all want to write. You know, they all want to do it. They got a good story, you know. And I know we spend like 5 or 15 minutes, and I just get, God, we need writers. We need writers more every day in this world. And nothing, no one has ever brought me anything.
Well, you know, there's just such a huge amount of failure involved. I mean, it's not surprising to me at all. I mean, Philip Roth said, if you can do anything else, do that. Like, he never encouraged anybody to be a writer. And I don't think I would either. I'd be like, look, you're going to have to go through so much weird failure shit. Like,
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even at the end of it, you still, what, you become Kafka? Like, for most people, that's not interesting, you know? Like, that's not interesting. Like, my life was meaningless, but I got this book that's on shelves that people talk about on podcasts. You know, like, for most people, it's like, well, that's not my life, you know? Like, that's just a book, you know? This, like, has nothing...
That's not my life. That's a song by Andrew Wills. I love it.
Really?
Yeah. That's not my life. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. Man alive,
I want to tell a quick story about
yes.
Andrew Wills.
Yes.
Because he's a
because
very,
he's one of our we're his fan.
Yeah.
Fans.
Yeah. He's a very talented musician, and he's a hand doctor, right? He's a surgeon.
Right. Right.
And one time I was in here and I was talking to him and he told me this story, which has stuck with me, and I'm just telling it to you now. It has no relation to anything else. He told me, when he was an undergrad, he got the textbook for whatever the biology or surgery class he was taking, and he wrote an inscription. He inscribed on the front of his book a do well inscription from the author of that book, just to freak out his fellow classmates, just so they'd be like, oh my God, this guy's got a he's got an autograph from the guy who wrote this book. And like, just that way of thinking, it just blew my mind, because it's like, that would never occur to me in a million years.
He's a Southerner.
It's just so fantastic. A description of his personality. Like, I can't think of anything better. It's like,
but he's a great musician and songwriter.
It's true.
It's like he's going to use every method available
at his disposal
to do something good, man. I know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, Andrew, full-time surgeon, and writes great songs and hangs out with people and helps them become better musicians. And plays like an angel. And you're going, God, how's he do it, man? Well, he just like covers every base all the time, man. So yeah, you and I have to start cheating more. And intimidating our opposition more.
Yeah, it's not even really cheating. It's just... It's brilliant. That's what I like about it.
Right.
I mean, it's really smart. But also on another level, it's ambitious in this way that sort of counteracts... the intelligence of it. It's like, if your ambition is too high, you're never really going to be engaged with why that thing was just worth doing on its own terms. You know, like, if you have this high level ambition for, like, it's why writers who aspire to be really popular or mm-hmm. aspire to make a big impact on the world, and that's why Kafka's good, right? It's like, that was not his aspiration. His aspiration was just to write good stories, you know. Like, if you have too much ambition, it actually undercuts your ability to create good art.
Well, it's not true.
You don't think so?
Andrew's probably the best musician in town.
Well, he's very technically adept.
No, he's a great songwriter.
Well,
no.
He's an okay songwriter.
Oh, no, I disagree totally. He's a really great song and storyteller. He's totally in the American grain, much more sophisticated than anything I write, and I've written a lot of songs. Very soulful guy, man. I think that if you and I had a little more of that chicanery, you know, we'd probably, you know, done something, you know. But no,
well,
I'm totally happy. I'm totally happy.
You're not wrong there, I'm sure.
I'm totally happy with where I am, man.
Yeah.
And the other interesting thing about Andrew that we have to say is he's totally a generous guy, man.
Oh, yeah.
He's okay. Totally generous. There's just nothing withholding about him. And we're glad that we can repeat. We're glad we're going to make him famous and buy his albums. They're out there somewhere. Andrew Wills.
Make him famous, yeah.
Oh, he's a great musician and songwriter. I think of the fact, I mean, basically, Andrew and you and I are hanging out in Pocatello, Idaho. And it's a long ways out in the big, you know, pebble dropped in the pool.
Yeah.
Outwards to, you know, even Seattle or somewhere. I love his plan, man. He's just great. And
yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to like disparage him or anything.
Oh no, you didn't. I've just heard more of his music than you have, and
yeah.
He's just like killer, man. He's just a great musician. But yeah, I would have never thought of that. But again, you know, Southerners they got to work harder, man. They got them Northerners up there. With more industrial capacity. Oh my God, we got little sirens going on here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I think tonight was probably the best podcast we've ever done, man.
I think it was pretty good.
Because Franz is up there going, man, these guys are like kicking it.
I hope we do him justice, honestly.
If we get a few people reading this stuff. But yeah,
he's so famous.
Forget about the trial. Forget about all this stuff. Just read his short stories, man. And he's just like a knockout, man.
Yeah. I would actually like somebody to seduce me more into telling me why the trial is interesting. Because, you know, I talked to this one guy who went at the Edinburgh Festival. He produced a play that was based off the trial. And if I was going to tell him how to produce a Kafka play, I would have been like, just do some parables. Like, get up there and, like, recreate some minor parables. Or
sure.
Do something funny with it. Like,
Brecht would do.
Yeah.
Bertolt Brecht would have said, yeah, the parables are great, man. I can do these. Yeah.
Like, there's something about the trial that's just trying to... Well, there's something about the trial that I cannot... disassociate in my mind from the band Pink Floyd.
Interesting.
Pink Floyd made that rock album, The Wall, and the main thing is like he's got like a judge and he's like slamming a gavel and he's like, you know, you've committed the sin of being alive, basically, you know, that kind of stuff. It seems to me like that's what the trial's about, right? Is you've committed this sin of being a person. I don't know, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, the trial is basically a stylistic concept of repetition of doom, and it's got the same logical thing, right? But it just can't. You just can't carry it out for that far, you know. But no, it definitely creates that. But it's just like you get it. Okay, I get it.
Yeah.
This is going to be calling an 800 number to change to figure out why they charged me too much, and I keep by an infinite.
And they're charging you while you call.
As you call. And it's an infinite regression of, please dial this number, this connection, and you dial that. I mean, it goes on and on. I mean, he foresees it.
Yeah.
So you get it, right?
Yeah.
But it's more a parable, you know, and I think that's the point of, you know, you have a concept. What is its limitations? Is it a parable? Is it a short story? Is it a novella? Is it really a novel? And,
yeah.
I mean, novels, novels are pretty tight action, man. You gotta really have it down.
Novels are pretty tight action, man.
You got to, and I finally figured out if like 10 years where mine was going, it's like 1,000 pages, and I'm really happy with it, you know. But I'd rather have those 20 years back, truly, really, man. If I look back, I was going, well, okay, that's the way it goes. But you laugh at me when I say that, but I'm sure Homer said, "Shit, did I really have to spend 20 years on the Iliad, the Odyssey?" Or it might have been 30 or 40 years, yeah, you know, for the perfection of those two pieces, man.
Yeah.
So.
Or maybe it was 2 days. No. Can't really know, right?
No, they figure the Odyssey was written 20 years. Yeah, they figure the Odyssey. He probably spent 20 years writing the Iliad, and then after a couple of years, he thought, well, I'll just...
How could they know that?
Well, because if you really read the Odyssey, there's a real kind of mature, ironic attitude,
yeah,
towards everything.
Yeah.
I mean, the Iliad, which just makes it so glorious, is that, and which brings back to you, it's going to be interesting to see your oeuvre over the last, you know, over your career. You could disparage what you wrote early, but the Iliad has just got this, like, boom, boom. And Ajax, you know, confronted Trojan name. You got to remember, the Trojans were Easterners and were Semitic. And the Greeks were the Nordics, right?
Okay.
And
the great
Trojan hero suddenly was struck by a bolt of fear by Athena, and struck by panic and turned to run, and Ajax thrust the spear back through the top of his back protector.
Yeah. Oh, right.
Which moved through his lungs and carried the liver out and impaled it on the stone before him, and he fell with his soul crying to Hades, right? I mean, you cannot beat poetry like this, man. And the Odyssey doesn't come close to it, because the Odyssey is court scenes and talking about and the reframing of these things, right? So they figure it's like at least 20 years. It's the difference between a 25, 30-year-old man and a 56-year-old man.
Okay. Well, I buy that. But right, that doesn't necessarily speak to how long it took him to write each individual word.
Oh, I think he wrote it. I think he did. I think he wrote, he might have started writing it at 25 or 30. He was 50 or 60. I mean, look at me. I'm 70. I'm still writing.
Yeah.
And, if you're a strong man,
It'll be interesting to see with this third one if there's any distinct change in style.
Oh, there's tremendous. Yes, totally different. Totally different. I mean,
you might as well just make it a different book then.
No, it continues it, man. Because I took so much abuse from the fact there was no plot in the first one, and then it started to surface in the second one. And now I'm going to say, okay, here it is. This is what was happening. And it's not far from the truth, which is really interesting.
Well, you might as well just let it be its own standalone thing, then.
I am.
Oh, okay.
Actually, I'm going to write it that way because I've got these in Odyssean, in the Odyssey.
Yeah.
See, the Iliad is not really about, the Iliad is about Achilles, and the Odyssey is about Odysseus. And the third book is actually more Odyssean because he's looking back to what really happened, right?
Well, that would be
And
interesting.
right.
That would be
Right, and
interesting.
that's how it's going down, and I'm having a great time, except I'm having to like cut out like 30 and 40 pages at a time of brilliant writing.
Yeah,
Jonah.
but that's so
Jonah,
good.
it hurts, man.
It's good for you. It's good for you.
It's good, man.
It's
It builds character. It builds character. Yeah, man. I've got 100 pages, man. These are compression waves coming in, and every scene is going to be like Macbeth. And it's going to be like everybody he talks to and interacts with, it's all going to be dealing on his doom. And so, yeah, but God, but you're proud of me. There was like 2 pages this morning. I thought I should cut this out, but I couldn't. I had to put it in there because it's the story of. He goes into the Las Iguanas, and the lady there, Bombacita there, has got some big gold, gilded cage with some conures. And
Some
Errol is
conures?
conures are these kind of like larger than parakeets.
Oh, okay.
And he's trying to whistle to him because he thinks they'll sing to him, but they won't. And this guy says, they don't whistle, actually, they're conures. And they're from South America, but they don't sing. And he says, and then the guy says, "Yeah, I mean, the macaws, South American macaws, they're the ones that sing." And he says, "Von Humboldt in 1810 was traveling there and met in his great journals of Alexander von Humboldt recounts that he meets this old Indian that's got two macaws in separate cages." And the old Indian tells him that when he got these like 30 years before, they were speaking a language that went extinct like 5 years later from the tribe that had captured them. And von Humboldt says, "Well, get them to talk and I'll transcribe this language extinct by a tribe of the lower Amazon basin 30 years before." And the Indian says, "That's why they're in separate cages. They got in a fight 20 years ago and have not spoken to each other since." How could I leave that out? I couldn't, Jonah. I just couldn't. So the next one is the big scene, so. So yeah.
Yeah, your writing is like a is like going into Ripley's Believe It or Not Museum or something. Like yeah,
Yes.
every page you turn and there's
Can I
just like
use that as a blurb?
yeah, sure.
That's gonna sell, man. Yeah.
Like every page you turn and there's just some other like just story you've collected.
I know.
You're
oh.
almost like a hoarder of
I
stories.
know, but gosh, the you talk about irony, man. Two parrots who are preserving the language of men, women, and children that were chattering away in the lower
Yeah.
Amazon and are now extinct.
Okay, but here's the true question.
Yes.
Is this guy lying to him? Right, is he has he just made up this story? It's like it's like no, they gotta be it's like he's just concocted in his whole head this background, you know.
Which I'm trying to bring in.
Is it still
Hi.
open?
We're not, darn it. What were you looking for?
Oh, it's just some music CDs.
There's some all the way back on the left-hand corner. We'll probably be here for another 10 minutes, probably. Certainly, yeah. Yes.
Music
I
CDs.
think I'm bringing that in, though, how many stories aren't. That's the main problem thing I'm bringing in is that, yeah, all the stories Errol hears that he believes is true.
Yeah.
Possibly none of them are.
Yeah.
It's great. It's really great. Yeah. It's really great.
Well, that one specifically. I mean, that one specifically, it just seems like they got in a fight 20 years ago. It's like, it's putting a lot of agency on those birds, you know?
Hey, look. Look, man. Mackie, Idaho, I'm glad you mentioned this, because I might put this in the novel to just kind of bracket what I...
Yeah.
What's already in it.
Yeah.
And I've got 100 pages to go, right? So, if you go up into Mackie, Idaho, and there's the Silver Dollar Bar on the left-hand side of the street on the corner, and you go in, and it's, there's like a 1890s bar that was brought in when the railroad came in there and they were mining there. This is like big-time, beautiful bar, right? And the best place in town. And I was sitting in there, and even 10 years ago, the only women that would hit on me were like aging bar owners, who was, and she was kind of cute, but she was telling me, and she even bought me a beer, the last time any bar owners bought me a beer. In Mackie, Idaho, it was like 2014, and she told me the story about the year before. There were two buddies that lived together in Mackie, and they came into her bar, and it was just the way the moon was, or it was like some kind of conjunction of the planets, or it was winter in Mackie, and they got in an argument, and one of the friends that, you know, there were, you know, gets up and walks out of the bar, and they're all, whatever was said, I don't know, but like 10 minutes later, his buddy who he's living with comes back down. They're not gay, right? No. Comes back with a big knife and puts that knife right through the guy's chest and says, hold this. And the guy dies right there. And the lady that bought me the drink said, yeah, he died right there. Going back to the otter and the beaver, mammals are not like reptiles, man. They get the blood up, man, and they'll just like kill each other. Or they won't speak for 30 years. It's happened, Joan, I'm telling
you,
man.
But that's not getting the blood up, right? Not speaking for 30 years is...
No.
I like your comparison of how that's not reptilian. Obviously, that's a social idea, right? Not speaking for 30 years. That's not really an instinctual idea. I mean, is even sticking a knife in a man's chest an instinctual idea? Probably not, right? I mean...
No, it's not instinctual at all. It's just like mammalian. You know, look at me. Okay, I can tell you, man... You and I just get along great, right? But I've gotten in fights, and it's just like, it's over. It's just like over, man. Like, years pass, and you're going, really, what was that fight about? Was that fight about anything? But you called somebody out, and it was like, somebody's going to die, and then it's over. You don't see him for like 20 or 30 years, man. I've had like two or three really good friendships end that way. So I know it's true. 30 years means nothing. I mean, granted, they're in the same building, you know, they're in the same hovel in the Amazon Valley, and they're in, but still,
I'm following your thread.
He couldn't leave them together. I'm guessing they were either both females or both males. That's what I'm thinking. There was some kind of like two males, two females, you know, something going on. Man.
I'm following your thread now. I think I was getting a little confused because I thought it had more to do with the language thing. Because I was thinking, like, well, why couldn't they still speak to each other?
You think they argued about a literary
thing? Well...
That would be better, man. Wait a second. You're using that grammar badly, man. What do you mean?
No, like, I just mean, like, they're in separate cages, but they're still close enough to each other to technically communicate, right?
No, they just got mad at each other and just stopped talking to each other.
They stopped anything.
But I mean, truly, man. I mean, the last big fight I've got, it's been like 10 years. You know, I see this guy on the street, but it's like we know if we get around each other, like, it's just not going to be good for either one of us. So let's just not talk about it. Let's just not talk, man. I mean, that's how it works, man. So I believe that he did, but yes, it could be a great story that could have no truth at all. Isn't that gorgeous?
A perfect Kafka story.
You never will know.
You'll never know the truth.
Yeah.
Actually,
yeah.
I'm interested in it, but yeah. That also seems like a very good way to end.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Perfect story, too.
Fantastic.
That has no truth at all. That's the metamorphosis. That's a parable. That's a parable, right?
We make no, legal, not justification. We are not liable for this broadcast.
Any comparisons to people.
To truth, people.
Any comparisons to persons real or imagined is simply coincidental and not this is yeah
great, man.